that Black women for centuries in this country have not been accorded dignity when they are carrying pregnancies to term and when they're carrying pregnancies to term that they want. And we should want it all. We should want that women should be able to survive and have dignity when they are pregnant and want to be pregnant. And we should also care about government coercively forcing women to carry pregnancies that they don't want for the benefit of random state legislators that these women do not even know.
Michelle Goodwin, we want to ask you to stay with us so we can talk more extensively, specifically about your book, Policing the Womb, Invisible Women and the Criminalization of Motherhood. And we'll post that at democracynow.org. Michelle Goodwin is Chancellor's Professor of University of California, Irvine School of Law. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
This is Mona Bowen of Film at 11 here on KBOO Portland, and it's time for the spring membership drive. As you know, KBOO is supported by listeners just like you, and because of that, we have access to Democracy Now!, many specialist shows, music of all kinds, and of course, Film at 11. Along with an online archive of every show. Becoming a member is easy. Go to KBOO FM and click on the red donate button in the upper right corner and follow the pointers. This spring, any donation up to $12,000 will be matched until the end of May. So please visit KBOO FM and click on the red donate button and help KBOO to continue to serve its listeners just like you.
Now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the latest plan to replace the interstate bridge has 8 lanes, up from the current 6. A new software adopted by first responders slows response times. And yesterday's commemoration of missing and murdered Indigenous people. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 6th, 2022. I'm Josh Salem. The latest proposal for a replacement of the interstate bridge will include 8 lanes for cars and a light rail between Oregon and Washington. Project planners presented the design to the Executive Steering Group on Thursday, which includes transportation officials and politicians from both states. Currently, the bridge has 6 lanes and no light rail. The added lanes are the most controversial part of the plan, with many environmental groups citing that more lanes will incentivize more car travel and that the traffic projections used are not accurate. Project staff call the extra lanes auxiliary lanes and are meant to address the safety problems that the 7 interchanges in and around the bridge create. As it stands, the amount of merging and lane changing required results in accidents. The last attempt at the project died in 2013. It planned for 10 lanes. Most of the bridge design isn't final yet, except for 3 basic things: 8 lanes, high-capacity light rail, and a partial interchange connection to Hayden Island. The Executive Steering Group will be providing input and modifications until the end of July. New software is causing major problems for Portland's 911 emergency response system. The Portland Bureau of Emergency Communication is the city agency in charge of emergency and non-emergency dispatch in Portland and several smaller suburban cities. In May of 2021, while still dealing with staffing shortages from the pandemic, the Bureau transitioned to new standardized scripts to dispatch fire and medical calls, known as ProQA. The transition to ProQA took years of planning. For a while after the transition, the Emergency Bureau established a 24-hour command center staffed with priority dispatch representatives and dispatchers from other counties and agencies already using ProQA. The city said the $2.3 million software would increase efficiency by making sure the right responders were being sent to emergencies. But dispatchers say the software has gummed up the 911 system, causing longer hold times and putting lives in danger. Immediately following the transition, caller hold times surged. An OPB investigation showed the number of people who waited 5 minutes or more for a 911 dispatcher to answer their call after the new software launched shot up almost 500% compared to the month before the program started. 9 months after implementation, it was up more than 800%. Dispatchers repeatedly told leadership at the Bureau that their work was being hampered. Some say their stress on the job has risen. Others have left. The software works through a set of standardized questions that are scripted, and the company that owns the software, Priority Dispatch, says the system ensures the right people with the right equipment are responding during emergencies. Fans of the software say that dispatchers can work their way through even the most complicated calls and efficiently determine the appropriate response by sticking to the scripts. The answer to each question determines the next step in the process. But opponents, including some dispatchers, say those rigid scripts force dispatchers to ask a bunch of irrelevant questions before sending fire or medical care to someone in a moment of crisis, and they make every call last longer. The director of the Emergency Bureau emphasized that the software helps them prioritize calls so responders don't show up with lights and sirens when they're not needed. Responses have changed under ProQA, according to Portland Fire and Rescue. The Fire Bureau stopped responding to some sick person calls, leaving them mostly to American Medical Response, a private ambulance company. But the Portland Firefighters Association says the new software may actually be increasing their workload. Dispatchers say the fallout from ProQA has made a stressful job nearly unbearable, driving some to quit and increasing the number of people taking leaves of absence, exacerbating the very staffing shortage management claims is responsible for the 911 delays plaguing the agency. Before using ProQA, dispatchers used a guide that was less rigid but got first responders on the road much faster. It gave dispatchers more flexibility to make critical decisions in emergencies. The amount of time it takes when a dispatcher answers the call to when it is sent to dispatch increased by as much as 20% in 2021, the longest it has taken since at least 2018. If every call takes longer, even if it's just a minute or two, dispatchers aren't answering incoming calls and a backlog builds. The average time it took to get through to 911 had increased from 13 seconds in June 2019 to 56 seconds in June 2021. This past summer, during peak call times, the wait time for emergency calls stretched to 4 to 5 minutes. Wait times for non-emergency calls increased from 1 minute 30 seconds to over 10 minutes, despite the fact that the Bureau of Emergency Communications received fewer non-emergency calls than in any of the previous 3 years. In March 2022, the last month for which data exists, only 40% of 911 calls were answered within 20 seconds. So why switch to a more rigid software? The new protocols may slow 911 call times, but for city officials concerned about legal risk, they have one massive benefit: liability protection. The International Academy of Emergency Dispatch is the industry organization that sets national dispatch standards. They require agencies to use ProQA to become accredited. The Academy provides assistance with litigation and liability management when agencies are accredited. Agencies in Pueblo, Colorado, Salt Lake City, Utah, and Minneapolis, Minnesota have all faced similar issues. Priority Dispatch was sued in 2019 when dispatchers never sent to police despite 4 calls reporting a home invasion to 911. The lawsuit alleges the police were never dispatched because call takers were unable to make their way through the required questions. After 2 years of using the protocols, Minneapolis abandoned them in 2019, citing many of the same issues surfacing in Portland, such as veteran staff leaving and complaints of excessive performance reviews. Commissioner Mingus Mapps, who oversees the Bureau, received a note saying, quote, "Admin will say the increased wait times are because of an increase in calls. This is incorrect. They are covering up the fact that all medical fire calls now take significantly longer to triage," end quote. Mapps stood by the software, saying, quote, "If there is one lesson here, it's that be very cautious about reorganizing your systems and your software in the midst of a surge on demand for your services. I know some are still skeptical about the software, skeptical of the value added here. I think I'm convinced that this is a direction we need to go in," end quote. Yesterday, May 5th, was Missing and Murdered Indigenous Persons Awareness Day, and events have been held this week to honor missing and murdered Indigenous women, including in Oregon. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. May 5th marked Missing and Murdered Indigenous Persons Awareness Day. Events have been held throughout the week, including in Springfield, Oregon, to honor missing and murdered Indigenous women. KLCC's Brian Bull has more.
Roughly 40 people came to hear poems about relatives and friends lost to violence or abduction. Co-organizer Marta Clifford is a Grand Ronde tribal member. She worked with students from the University of Oregon and Lane Community College on the ceremony.
Our voices have power. We spoke to the people that are missing and murdered, and we know they heard us. So that's what I want the students to take away, that their voices matter. They made a difference tonight.
The event hit home for Megan Van Pelt, a U of O junior from the Umatilla Indian Reservation.
I know too many aunties, I know too many cousins, I know too many of my friends who've gone through sexual assault. And I guess today is making space for ourselves. And we are here for our lost sisters, our lost cousins.
The Indian Resource Law Center says over half of Native women have experienced sexual violence. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull in Springfield, Oregon.
Tribal advocates met this week to discuss the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. It provides a framework to help ensure their survival. The UN adopted the declaration in 2007, but the U.S. has yet to implement it. Keith Harper, Cherokee Nation, is the first Native American to become a U.S. ambassador. He points out America's position is that the declaration is aspirational in nature. But, he says,
and the fact that they're aspirational rather than binding, I don't think should be of much import, because you still should have a plan to reach the aspiration.
Countries such as Canada, New Zealand, and Mexico are taking steps to implement the declaration. Tribal advocates in the U.S. say one outcome would be closer consultation with tribes on key issues. Some Alaska Native elders must make the tough choice of whether to give their Native corporation shares away to be eligible for federal programs like SNAP. As KNBA's Trip J. Krause reports, legislation introduced in Congress may help.
Before the late Alaska U.S. Congressman Don Young died, he introduced House Resolution 437. The legislation would amend the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act to exclude certain payments to Alaska Native elders when determining eligibility for need-based federal programs, such as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. The U.S. House Subcommittee for Indigenous People held a hearing for testimony on a series of tribal-related measures, including Young's legislation. California Republican U.S. Congressman Jay Obernolte is acting ranking committee member.
This discrepancy between the types of income from ANCs can place many Alaska Native elders in the position of having to choose between accepting settlement trust income on the one hand or qualifying for government assistance on the other, and obviously that's not a situation we would want to put anyone in.
During testimony, Chugach Alaska Corporation Board Chairman Sherry Beretta spoke before the subcommittee.
Perhaps one of the most meaningful benefits we provide is annual dividend distributions, critical income source for many of our people. This is particularly true for our elders, many of whom live in our remote communities and face a harsh environment. The effect of this bill on the budget is marginal, but the impact on our Alaska Native elders is significant.
House Resolution 437 was introduced in January. In Anchorage, I'm Trip J. Krause.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Amazon's union head testifies in a Senate hearing. In Congress, we'll hold a vote to codify Roe v. Wade in the wake of the Supreme Court's draft opinion. With those stories and more, it's Nadia Ramagan with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
She will be the first Black woman, the first out LGBTQ plus person to serve in this role, which is amazing because representation matters.
Jen Psaki introduced Karine Jean-Pierre Thursday as the next White House press secretary. Jean-Pierre will assume the role May 13th when Psaki steps down and heads to MSNBC. Amazon's labor union president, Chris Smalls, testified Thursday in a Senate hearing on whether Amazon and other companies should be barred from receiving federal contracts if they engage in anti-union activities. Smalls responded to questioning by South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham.
It's not a a left or a right thing. It's not a Democrat or a Republican thing. It's a workers' thing. It's a workers' issue. And we're the ones that are suffering.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer confirmed Congress will vote next week to codify the Supreme Court's abortion decision in Roe v. Wade, following the leak of a draft opinion which could, if finalized, overturn the 1973 landmark decision.
Next week's vote will be one of the most important we ever take because it deals with one of the most personal and difficult decisions a woman ever has to make in her life.
Chief Justice John Roberts called the leak, quote, absolutely appalling during an appearance Thursday at the 11th Circuit Judicial Conference. The Justice Department says it's opening a new office to advance environmental justice for communities disproportionately impacted by poor air and water quality and exposure to toxics. EPA Administrator Michael Regan.
I'm talking about children going to school right next door to chemical plants. Generations of family members diagnosed with cancer.
The FDA will restrict use of Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 vaccine for adults 18 and over who would not otherwise become vaccinated against COVID over concerns of rare side effects, including blood clots. According to NBC News, the number of people who've died from COVID-19 across the United States has now passed 1 million since the first case was reported in Washington State in early 2020. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization reports almost 15 million deaths were caused either directly or indirectly by COVID-19 in 2020 and 2021. The judge overseeing the federal civil rights cases of four former Minneapolis police officers involved in the killing of George Floyd says he's accepted the terms of Derek Chauvin's plea agreement and will sentence him to 20 to 25 years in prison. Chauvin could have faced life in prison. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to a spring membership Hive Drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. You can help support KBOO and become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines from fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sona Lee. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 51 degrees. Tomorrow, the rain continues with a high of 54. Today in history, in 1940, author John Steinbeck was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for his novel, The Grapes of Wrath, following a poor family of tenant farmers in Dust Bowl, Oklahoma. The quote of the day is from Steinbeck. It is a common experience that a problem difficult at night is resolved in the morning after the Committee of Sleep has worked on it. One of the men convicted of the murder of Ahmaud Arbery spoke with a local district attorney several times by phone in the days and weeks following the 2020 killing, according to a court document filed yesterday. Jackie Johnson, then the Brunswick Judicial Circuit District Attorney, placed a 9-minute phone call to Greg McMichael the day after the murder. Johnson faces a misconduct case that includes 16 calls between Johnson and McMichael starting February 23, 2020, about an hour after the shooting, and ending May 5, 2020, the day after graphic cell phone video of Arbery's killing was leaked online. The video sparked a national outcry over the young black man's death at the hands of 3 white pursuers. The men were convicted of murder and given life sentences. They were also convicted of hate crimes. A grand jury indicted Johnson last year on a felony charge of violating her oath of office, as well as a misdemeanor count of hindering a police investigation. Johnson is alleged to have used her position to protect McMichael and his son. Prosecutors said, quote, the evidence shows that Johnson showed favor and affection for McMichael throughout the pendency of the case, including when she was making decisions as the DA over his case, end quote. Johnson has insisted she recused herself immediately from the investigation and turned the case over to outside prosecutors. Her attorneys have asked the judge to dismiss the charges, saying there is no evidence she interfered with the police investigation. Johnson lost her re-election contest for district attorney in November 2020 and blamed public outrage over the delay in arrests over Arbery's death. The final call consisted of Greg McMichael leaving a voicemail thanking Johnson for a referral, the legal filing said. He said, quote, "He's gonna run interference for me right now, and that's damn good advice, and I appreciate that very much," end quote. Watchdogs say the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Labor Department's Occupational Safety and Health Administration should have collaborated more to protect workers at meatpacking plants during the pandemic. Lily Bolke has more on the story in Missouri.
An inspector general's report from the U.S. Department of Labor says government agencies should have collaborated in the early days of the pandemic to protect workers at meatpacking plants from the coronavirus. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has food safety inspectors in every large meatpacking plant in the country, but the report says the Trump administration saw no role for the agency in protecting workers. Adam Pulver with Public Citizen says the Labor Department's Occupational Safety and Health Administration should have gotten more involved, but documents reveal OSHA let USDA take responsibility for workers and COVID-19.
The USDA had a very pro-industry view and did very little, if anything, to protect workers and kind of went out of its way to interfere with state and local governments that were attempting to protect workers and the public health.
According to Investigate Midwest, more than 400 meatpacking workers have died from COVID-19. OSHA has faced criticism for failing to inspect every plant where cases were publicly reported and only issuing fines to a handful of plants. Agency leaders have said they were committed to protecting workers but had too few inspectors and an increase in the number of workplaces to oversee. Missouri, like other Midwestern states, has hundreds of meatpacking plants. The Inspector General's report notes OSHA should have provided worker safety training to USDA inspectors in the plants. Pulver says Congress should work to delineate clear responsibilities for the different agencies.
Congress really can speak and make clearer that OSHA is around to protect workers from infectious diseases at the work site. Two, I think that there's a massive need to reform transparency laws, and there should be a lot of pressure to make things much more transparent about the way industry and government is interacting.
Investigate Midwest has tracked nearly 500 meatpacking plants with reported COVID cases between March 2020 and March of this year, but OSHA conducted just 157 inspections. Pulver says more clear responsibilities and transparency can help foster collaboration between agencies. Sky Chad wrote this article for the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting via the Daily Yonder. This is Lily Bolke with Missouri News Service.
A student at a military college filed a lawsuit yesterday alleging that armed services officials deemed him unfit for service because he tested positive for HIV. He tested positive for HIV in October 2020 during his sophomore year at Norwich University in Northfield, Vermont. Norwich, the oldest private military college in the United States. He said in a complaint filed in federal court that he was deemed unfit for service and dropped from the Reserve Officers Training Corps and the Vermont Army National Guard despite being healthy, asymptomatic, and on a treatment regimen that renders his viral load undetectable. He was informed that he would not be able to get a scholarship through the ROTC or be entitled to other benefits related to military service, such as a state tuition waiver or medical and dental coverage. The student's discharge documents say he was terminated from the Guard in January for being, quote, not medically qualified, end quote. HIV is one of many health conditions that automatically disqualify a person from enlisting, being appointed as a commissioned officer, or enrolling as an ROTC scholarship cadet, according to Department of Defense regulations. The student's lawyers argue the military's HIV policies date to the 1980s, when little was known about the condition. The lawsuit states, quote, "A generation after they were first developed, the military's policies are highly anachronistic and fail to reflect current medical reality. Advances in medical treatment and prevention have transformed HIV from a progressive terminal disease to a manageable condition," end quote. A federal judge in Virginia ruled last month that service members who are HIV positive cannot be discharged or barred from becoming an officer solely because they're infected with the virus. The student's case is unrelated, though, because the Virginia ruling only applied to those already in military service. Through the suit, the student hopes to restore his military standing, and it asked the court to invalidate the military regulations and policies that led to his dismissal from the National Guard and the ROTC. Spokespeople for the U.S. Department of Defense and the Vermont National Guard, which are both named in the suit, declined to comment, citing the pending litigation. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and teachers and health experts are urging parents to take a closer look at how social media is impacting upon young kids' mental well-being. Jonah Chester has the details.
Last year, a whistleblower at Facebook lifted the curtain on how the platform and its sister companies impact young kids' mental health. Now, alongside teachers and health experts, Francis Haugen is raising concerns about the long-term effects social media can have on kids. In an event this week hosted by the American Federation of Teachers, the former Facebook employee described the corrosive effects social media have on kids' mental well-being as a public health crisis.
If we hold, you know, children's toys to a product liability standard where you need to demonstrate you did safety by design, you know, why aren't we asking the same thing of these virtual products for children, especially as we move into the land of the metaverse, which is going to be an emergent harm?
Haugen argues social media companies should be held to congressionally mandated standards, an idea which has rare bipartisan support on Capitol Hill. Meta, Facebook's parent company, argues they already have adequate internal safeguards and protocols. Among other things, Haugen revealed leaders at Instagram, which is also owned by Meta, knew the platform's algorithm fed kids potentially harmful content, but opted to essentially double down in order to drive user engagement. Dahlia Hashad with the Washington, D.C.-based organization Parents Together says such strategies have long-term consequences.
Without fail, the longer a child spends online, the higher their level of anxiety, the higher the level of mood swings, aggressive behavior, feelings of worthlessness.
Dr. Warren Ng with the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychology says having open lines of communication can help prevent those issues before they arise. He explains that starts with simply asking kids how they're doing.
And don't ask them in a way that you're okay, right? No, really ask them, like, things are really tough right now. How are you doing? And really mean being open to that, but also being open to hearing not good news.
The AFT has an archive of previous webinars and educational resources for parents and teachers looking to provide emotional and psychological support for students. For the Virginia News Connection, I'm Jonah Chester.
Moms are pushing Massachusetts utilities to transition to renewable heat sources. Mothers Out Front wants customers to be able to heat their homes with renewable electricity and geothermal energy. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In Massachusetts, a group of moms is calling on the state's utilities to help consumers transition from natural gas to clean sources of heat. They say that continuing to use fossil fuels is bad for the climate and people's health.
The future of our children is at stake, the future of our planet. And it's very hard to sit back and do nothing as mothers. We want to protect our children. We want to protect all of life here on Earth.
Kathleen Scanlon of Brookline, Massachusetts, is part of Mothers Out Front, a nationwide group pushing for climate solutions. Last November, Mothers Out Front delivered more than 3,000 postcards to Massachusetts utilities from customers who wrote in support of the group's Future of Clean Heat platform. The platform demands that the utilities make plans to help buildings run entirely on renewable electricity. It calls for subsidies that make electric heat pumps affordable for all. And it asks for more investment in large-scale geothermal heating and cooling systems instead of natural gas pipelines.
There's all kinds of new proven technologies that we are more than ready to start implementing, and the market needs to catch up.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to a spring membership Hive Drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Friday, May 6th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes myself, Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Nadia Ramlagan, Antonia Gonzalez, Lily Bolke, and Jonah Chester. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. We are in a spring membership hive drive, so now is a great time to join us. If you'd like to become a member and support your local community radio station, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.
Queen Ida, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM on the radio. Your spot for Cajun and Zydeco music. Bon ton roulette.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, listeners are aware of the no less destructive for being baseless assault on critical race theory. Just like with affirmative action, where conservatives said steps